passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Baseball America Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined by Peter Flaherty, and we are here to break down the National League Central 2023 draft classes. So, Peter, what's been going on with you, man, before we get into these drafts? How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. Excited, as always, to break down another division, another five draft classes with you. Have been doing well on the fantasy football side. I'm 2-0, which I'm happy about. It doesn't matter that it's an eight-team league. I'll take 2-0 any day. And then have been, unfortunately, dealing with BC football. Although they did play FSU really well, and I'm sucked back in. But they sit at 1-2. But I'm happy about my fantasy team.
Well, your fantasy team is doing better than mine. In my two leagues, I am collectively 1-3. And in the league that I'm really into, 0-2. So that's not been great. I need Bryce Young to be a little bit better. And it seems like I'm great at picking the absolute worst starters possible. So we have like massive benches, and I just always am putting the wrong guys in, clearly. So it's not great for me. In terms of football, I did go to a UNC football game recently, which is, it's been a while, and they did beat Minnesota. So that was kind of cool. And I got to see a few players who actually came from our county who were on the UNC team playing. So that was kind of fun to see. But
there we go.
That was good. But I'm mostly excited about the MLB at this point. We're kind of in the most fun time of the year, maybe. Like, the anticipation for the playoffs is starting, and there are a few, maybe one decent playoff race. But the final days of the regular season is always fun to see who sneaks in. And maybe tonight I'll be able to see Ronald Acuña Jr. hit 40 home runs, because he's the Braves are in Washington tonight, so I could easily jet over there. So I'm hoping to make that happen.
Yeah, you mentioned that. I am now extra pulling for Acuña to do it tonight, given that you'll be in attendance. And yeah, like you said, with the last week and a half of the regular season, there's really nothing better than September baseball, especially when there are a couple of good wild card races going on. You have the Rangers and the Mariners in the AL, and then you've got the Marlins and the Cubs jostling, and the Reds jostling for that third wild card spot in the NL. The Giants at this point, I think, are very much on the outside looking in, three games back at this point. But a couple of fun races to follow. And then the postseason is the postseason. If you're a baseball fan listening to this, you know why the postseason is so great. But every single pitch, you're kind of sitting on the edge of your seat. Every pitch matters so much more. It's a really, really intense and fun, high-stakes environment. So we're getting into a very exciting time of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be fun to see. But yeah, let's jump into our draft classes today. So we've got the NL Central today to break down. A bit of an odd order this year, just given what the Cardinals have done in terms of how we'll go through it. But we'll start with the Brewers. They're at the top of the division, have been a really strong club all year. They were picking kind of in the back half of the middle third of the draft. That I certainly overcomplicated where they were picking. They're picking 18th. That's significantly more clear than I made it seem like it was. But in the first round this year, they took Brock Wilkin, a third baseman out of Wake Forest. They had a supplemental pick at number 33 overall. They took high school right-hander Josh Knoth there. In the second round, they took Nebraska Omaha third baseman Mike Bove. In the third round, they took California shortstop Eric Batanti. In the fourth round, they took Florida Gulf Coast right-handed pitcher Jason Woodward. And in the fifth round, they took junior college right-handed pitcher Ryan Burchard. So we get one of our maybe polarizing or interesting college third basemen that we talked about a number of times throughout the spring, Peter, leading off this draft class. But what are your thoughts on Milwaukee's group here? I think I labeled it as physical hitters or large hitters and pitchers with spin. It seemed like all the hitters they took were just physical players, and all of their pitchers had some ability to spin the baseball. It definitely seems like something they value in Milwaukee. But what are your thoughts on this draft class?
It's an interesting class, and I think that Wilkin and Bovee are pretty similar build-wise. Wilkin's a little bigger and I think a little more athletic-looking than Bovee is, but they're two drastically different players when it comes to what they profile as. With Wilkin, obviously, the calling card is his big-time raw power. He's shown it off early on for the Brewers. He's hit his way to Double-A, kind of referencing what we did last week with the NL East and Yo-Yo Morales. We compared Yo-Yo Morales and Brock Wilkin this past spring, and they've each gotten a Double-A. Each have shown relatively well. But with Wilkin, again, it's big-time raw power to all fields. The approach has actually been solid. He's just swinging and missing a little bit. I think that with Wilkin, the biggest question is where he's going to end up positionally long term. Is he going to be able to stick at third? Is he going to slide over to first base? So far he's played most of the time at third base. They're going to use him at third base for as long as they can. I know that for a fact. But again, he's shown really well. I think that the approach, again, it improved year to year in college, and it's still improving in professional baseball, which has been really positive to see. And then with Bovee, again, physical build, but he's going to have to really, really hit. I think it's a tick below average raw power right now. Struggling in high A, but I think that he'll adjust. There's a really good wood bat track record there too with Bovee. Outstanding summer in the Northwoods League 2 years ago, was a Cape All-Star in 2022. I know from watching him that he can absolutely handle quality pitching. But there were some struggles in high A, but I feel confident in his ability to adapt. It's a very much contact oriented profile. Is an 88 overall percent contact rate at Omaha with 92% in zone contact rate. And there isn't a ton of chase, which I think is encouraging. Like, you're seeing the ball well. He's just missing it. And again, high A, especially in the Midwest League, it is very, very good baseball and a very tough non-hitter friendly league. So with Bovee, I think that he'll end up doing well. And the key for him is going to have to be, he'll need to hit his way to the big leagues, which, mm-hmm. I think that's a guy that you can feel reasonably confident in. They wouldn't have used a second round pick on him if they didn't.
Yeah, two offensive oriented college profiles. I agree with you on pretty much across the board with both. I probably think Wilkin is going to be a first baseman in the long run, barring some pretty significant improvements with him defensively at third. So seeing the approach carry over into pro ball, seeing him continue to walk at a higher rate, I think is encouraging. If you feel like most of his value is going to have to come from the bat, that's good. If he's giving some OBP with that raw power that he has, I have no questions about the raw power with him. I do wonder what sort of pure hitter he's going to wind up being. So if you can add on that just foundation of on-base skills and help out the consistency of his at-bats, I think that'll be really encouraging. But they took these college hitters and kind of sandwiched in between and behind them a few high-upside young high school prospects. Josh Knoth was a pretty steady riser throughout the spring. I think some of the best field to spin a breaking ball in the high school class. His curveball and slider both have a chance to be plus pitches. He can spin them near 3,000 RPMs. He's earned some 70 grades on the breaking balls. It's like low 90s to 96. He's touched 98 before. It's not the biggest frame, but it's a pretty simple operation. He repeats well. Just a lot of really positive indicators. We have above average control on him in the future. So if he's able to actually hit on that projection for the control grade with that sort of breaking ball, that's a really fun and exciting pitch. I like the fact that Milwaukee seemed to be willing to take a couple of risky profiles. I think any high school right-handed pitcher probably qualifies for that, and certainly Eric Batanti does as well in the third round. Quite a bit more physical than Noth was. Again, I mentioned how physical all their hitters seem to be, but he was one of the youngest players in the class, but he certainly doesn't look like that. He 6'5", 230 pounds, a ton of raw power from the left side, a pretty impressive athlete for his size as well. The fact that he was drafted as a shortstop, I feel like I've mentioned this every single time we've had one of these podcasts, Peter, but there are a number of players who I don't anticipate being shortstops who were selected as shortstops, and Batanti has gotten a few innings there in pro ball. I think he's probably going to be a corner guy in the long run, but he certainly has the power to profile there. It'll just be a matter of how good is the hit tool with Batanti. He'd shown some swing and miss issues at times. There's some length to the swing. There may be some holes that can get created there offensively, but he is quite young. So I imagine he'll be a guy who they give a little bit more time to figure things out and adjust to the pro game. But I think this is a nice kind of complement of high upside high school players with some college bats that maybe you can feel a little bit safer with around them.
Yeah, and Josh Knott's a guy that I really fell in love with as did essentially everyone, I think. But I really liked – he really grew on me in the 2023 draft cycle you mentioned. Up to 98 with 2+ breaking balls. The ability for him at his age and at this stage to be able to control really all of his offerings and have a legit above average control is pretty rare nowadays for a high school arm. And I think, again, the strike throwing ability combined with the stuff is a very, very intriguing combination. He's got an electric arm, super, super quick arm. As you said, repeats his operation well. I like the upside. And then going back to the college side, they took a couple of college arms in the fourth and fifth, respectively, in Jason Woodward and Ryan Burchard. Woodward, a right-hander from Florida Gulf Coast, and Burchard, a right-hander from Niagara County Community College. Woodward missed most of the 2023 season with an injury for Gulf Coast. Fastball be 91-94, plays really well at the top of the zone. There's a ton of carry with it. And then the calling card with him is his changeup, which is a legit plus pitch. It just kind of falls off the table 2 to 3 feet from the plate. Slider and breaking ball, it's a little iffy. I'd say it's about average. But again, I think that it's a safer fourth, fifth starter type guy down the road. And then with Burchard, I'm really interested to see how they develop him in Milwaukee, especially with their track record of developing these guys with thunderous stuff. I'd say it's a very obvious reliever profile, at least right now with Burchard, but he's been up to 98-99 with a slider that's looked good. I think that, again, it's super relievery, but and it's hard to compare anyone to Jacob Mizorowski, but you kind of see what Milwaukee's done with these higher upside guys, and it's hard not to be excited about his effectiveness, even out of the back end of the bullpen, down the road, even as a two-pitch guy.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the other high school players they took on day two is Cooper Pratt. The Brewers kind of took this strategy where they underslotted a lot of their first few players and pushed money towards later high school picks like Batanti in the third and then Cooper Pratt in the sixth. He signed for $1.3 million in the sixth round for an overslot bonus that was over $1 million entirely. Batanti was overslot almost $1 million as well. They pushed some savings to day three as well. We might get into some day three guys. But Cooper Pratt, I thought, was a really fun pick in the sixth round. He had some of the best pure like plate discipline and contact ability in the class. His end zone contact rate throughout a pretty lengthy high school career that we have data for was tremendous. I mean, his miss rate on end zone pitches was just 6%. He doesn't chase out of the zone too frequently. Just makes a lot of contact, a lot of good swing decisions. And so far in pro ball, it's not a massive sample, just 54 plate appearances, but he'd hit well, 356, 426, 444, maybe even a little higher strikeout rate than I would have expected for someone like him. But I think that's a fun one. I like the tools across the board. It's solid average or better, I think, across the board. Curious to see if he can stick at shortstop. maybe he'll have a chance to, but he is a little bit bigger for the position. I think his actions might wind up being better for maybe third base or second base in the future, but it's a good arm, so maybe that'll help him stay on the left side of the infield. But overall, very solid tools, and I just like the traits of his hitting ability and his batting eye offensively. So that was one of the more fun, I would say, like post top five round picks in the draft overall.
Yeah, without a doubt. And there are a couple arms, one on day two, one on day three, that I'm a fan of, or at least intrigued by. Greg Yoho in the eighth is one, and he's really just a finished product at this point. Pretty old for the class. He's going to turn 24 in almost a month to the day, I think. But he's a junk baller through and through, very relievery. Throws his fastball only 40% of the time, but changeup, curveball, and slider, I think, they're just obviously distinct offerings. He has two distinct breaking balls. They each had miss rates over 55% in school. Only threw 2 2/3 of the complex this spring. He'll be an interesting one to follow, or excuse me, this past summer. And then Bishop Letson is an upside play in the 11th, who I think that they bought down. But he's someone I think that provides big time upside and really good clay to mold. He moves super well. It's an electric arm speed. Fastball is 92, 94 with a lot more coming. He's never really had a pitching coach growing up, so he's still a little raw. And it's outstanding clay. It's two quality off-speed offerings. I think that he's someone that could really pop.
Yeah, I really like a lot of the arms they took on day three. You mentioned Letson. I think Bjorn Johnson is another sort of projectable arm they took and spent a lot of money to get on day three. He signed for $420,000. Letson signed for $482,000. I think Letson has a little less now stuff even than Johnson has a little bit less now stuff than Letson does. He's kind of a funky slot from the left side, almost fully sidearm at times. I think that creates some deception, but it also creates some inconsistency with his breaking ball. The changeup in the past has at least been the more consistent secondary for him. But I think he's a fascinating arm. And then one of the other pitchers I really loved them taking on day three is Jacob Golston. Now, they didn't sign Golston, so I don't want to spend too much time on him, but he very quickly became one of my like personal cheese balls in this draft class. I think he has a phenomenal frame. I think he's got a really nice delivery, a fast arm. I think it's been like 88 to 93. I think there's going to be more fastball velocity to come in the future. The secondaries need a little bit more refinement as well, but I really just love the way this looks on the mound. He's going to Oklahoma now, and I think he's definitely going to be a like pick to click for me in a few years. I can't wait to see what he does in college. So it would have been nice if they signed him, but I think starting off with two arms like Letson and Johnson on day three is pretty exciting enough as well.
I was going to say, I know Golston, even talking through this spring, he was one of your favorite guys on the high school circuit. And I'm
just falling in love with the video with him.
And I know that I think that he's a guy that, again, is going to really pop at Oklahoma. I'm excited to see what he does after 3 years in college.
Yeah. Any other players you want to mention with the Brewers before we move on? I think it's a pretty well-balanced class. There's some interesting bats. There's some interesting arms. Not a ton of players that I feel confident in that are going to be up the middle players, but there's certainly a few shortstops that have a chance. But I do think it's solid for a team that is such a good pitching development group to have some of the arms and arm talent that they got in this class, particularly further down the board.
I think I agree with that assessment. I think I'm more overall, even with the headliners positionally with Wilkin and Bovee and Batanti, I think I'm more of a fan of the arms, especially given the developmental aspect. Again, Mark, going back to day, there are a lot of these guys on day two or day three that they have a chance to look really smart on. Mark Manfredi's another one that I thought looked really good on the Cape. 16 Ks to 4 walks and 13 innings. ERA just a tick over 2, was up to 94 of this fastball that had plenty of life to it. I thought the breaking ball was a quality off-speed offering. Just not the biggest names that they necessarily drafted, but guys that I think that have a chance to really pan out. So I think a lot of fun arms to follow.
Yeah, definitely. And then moving on to the Cubs, who are next up in the NL Central. They took a little bit of a different direction, a lot more hitter-friendly in this class. but I'll quickly run through their top five round picks. In the first round at number 13 overall, they took Maryland shortstop Matt Shaw. With a comp pick after the second round, they took Arkansas right-handed pitcher Jackson Wiggins. In the third round, they took Florida shortstop Josh Rivera, one of the best senior signs in the class. In the fourth round, they took South Carolina right-handed pitcher Will Sanders. And then in the fifth round, they took Davidson catcher Michael Carrico. So it was very hitter heavy. It gets even more hitter heavy as we move down the draft. I guess the first five picks aren't exactly hitter heavy, pretty good balance at top, but college heavy early on. A few interesting Puerto Rican prospects after that. And obviously Matt Shaw, on top of just being a prominent and obvious first round talent in his own right, has been really tremendous in pro ball. I think you could say that he had one of the better pro debuts of anyone in this class, a 357, 400, 618 average moving to double A. Ton of power already, 8 home runs, 4 triples, 9 doubles in just 170 plate appearances. And he's also continuing to add that speed that he always showed in college as well. So the power speed combo from Maryland has translated very nicely early on to pro ball. Peter, where are you at with this Cubs draft class?
I like it. And a lot of that hinges on the Matt Shaw pick, who is a personal favorite of mine. You touched on it, but I mean, he's raking so far. He's hit his way to double A, where he showed well in 15 games for Tennessee. Hit 292 with 4 doubles, 3 home runs. And you mentioned, I think he's an above average borderline plus runner at this point. And I think his running ability and base running ability is enhanced by his outstanding baseball IQ. He is a baseball rat through and through. He really understands the game. The makeup is off the charts, and the intangibles, I think, contribute to, you know, obviously the baseball sense. And then he swings a super quick bat. There's impact to all fields. I think it's above average raw power with a plus hit tool. He's going to probably be a second baseman long term, which, again, I think is more than okay. One with second base becoming more of a premium position, I'd say, at least with a legitimate second baseman. And then also with how much he's going to hit and has already hit, I think that he'll more than make up for, you know, maybe not sticking at shortstop. And I think that it's outstanding bat to ball. A lot of good traits that have translated well to professional baseball so far. He dominated the Cape League last summer, and he really hasn't stopped since then. And I think that he's got a chance to be in the big leagues, you know, at some point next season at this rate.
Yeah, it's been a pretty exceptional start. I think it's really encouraging, too, that the power has translated. I know there was some skepticism of his amateur power numbers just because Maryland is generally viewed as a pretty nice place to hit. But what always stood out to me about Shaw specifically is just the strength he has in his wrists and his forearms. He has, like, surprisingly impressive raw power, and to see that translate to Wood is encouraging. You mentioned the questions about his defensive role. He has played 10 games at second base and 20 games at shortstop. And I think even prior to the draft, most people expected him to move to second base. That'd be more of a natural fit for his defensive tools. And I think, like you said, it's probably going to be fine for him, given what he's going to do for you offensively, given the speed he can provide, the power he can provide. And second base is not exactly a bottom of the scale defensive spectrum position. So I think they'll be more than happy with what he's able to do for them in the middle of the infield. A few interesting arms they took after that, and I guess the Rivera pick is interesting because he is sort of this post-hype prospect who was very well-regarded coming out of high school, had a lot of expectations early on at Florida, never really had everything click, dealt with some injuries for a few years, even going back to high school. I remember watching him play with the Florida Burn travel ball team at Jupiter. I think this was his senior spring, and he really powered that team to a championship, and I was kind of impressed with his ability to hit to the opposite field. And then this year, it seems like he broke out in kind of the way everyone was expecting him to once he went to Florida. It was a pretty tremendous year. Hit 348, 447, 617, 19 homers. Better walk and strikeout rate than he'd shown before. And he's been a pretty solid defender at shortstop as well. So he's maybe one of the more interesting players in this draft class, just given his pedigree as a prospect, his status as a senior, and his performance this spring. And then he's sandwiched in between two arms that dealt with injuries and dealt with lack of performance. But I'm curious what you think of all these three college players.
Yeah, I think touching on Rivera first, obviously he had the career year at Florida, and you mentioned his prospect status, or, you know, draft stock, so to speak, has been a little bit of a roller coaster. Was one of the more, I'd say, fast or prominent risers in the 2023 draft cycle, at least on the college side. I think that coming into this year, he was viewed as like maybe a late day two, early day three type of guy. And, you know, so far so good. The early returns in affiliated baseball, it's big time bat speed. It's borderline violent, which at Florida, it was fine. It played well. There wasn't a ton of swing and miss, but so far, at least professionally, there's, I'd say he's having his fair share of swing and miss. He's, the approach has been, I'd say, fine, but he is missing a lot. So I think that that's going to be something to refine going forward. But he has shown impact to all fields, like you said. It's impressive how he can drive the ball into the right center field gap. But it's especially solid impact to the pull side, and he's going to stick on the left side of the infield. So I think refining the operation a bit at the plate and toning it down is going to go a long way for Rivera long term.
Yeah, definitely. And then we've got Jackson Wiggins, who was the first pitcher they took, signed him for $1.4 million, and Will Sanders, who signed for $600,000. Maybe a bit of a fall from grace for Will Sanders, given the expectations he had entering the year. We had him as one of the top college pitchers in the class entering the year. And I just think he's a guy who's never really performed as much as the pure stuff you would expect of him. He posted a 5.37 ERA over 11 starts and 60 innings, a 27% strikeout rate, 28% strikeout rate, 9.4% walk rate. The velocity is solid. There's carry on the fastball, but it's always played down a bit from that velo and movement than you would expect. I mean, maybe it's a guy that just doesn't have great deception. I know that he's tinkered with getting a little bit of movement on that fastball, whether that's two-seam or trying to get a little cut action. But there's interesting pure stuff and physicality to work with here. It's a 6'5", 6'6", right-handed pitcher who can get his fastball into the upper 90s. But I think you probably need a little bit more command or a little bit more movement on the fastball to really help everything else click. But where are you at with Sanders?
Yeah, I'm with you on with Wiggins at the very least. It's premium velo, super quick arm, changeup slash plus. I think the breaking ball has been inconsistent at best. And like you said, there's going to be stuff to clean up for at least me. And I think that for the player development people also to be convinced that he's a starter long term is coming off Tommy John. But Will Sanders in the fourth, I think that coming into the 2023 season, at least early in the draft cycle, he was viewed as a potential top half, top 20 overall pick in the entire draft. And he was inconsistent at South Carolina. The bad for Sanders was really bad. But the good was, I mean, you saw why he had that top half of the first round buzz. It's a big league body, 6'6", pretty durable. Fastball is 92, 94 up to a 5 and a 6. I think that the biggest thing for him is going to be improving the fastball shape and getting more misses with it, because the breaking ball, he says he throws a slider and a curveball, or at least it's labeled as such. It kind of blends shape at times, but yeah, regardless of what it is, I think it's a plus pitch. The changeup's also an above average borderline plus pitch. The key for him is just going to be getting more misses with the fastball, because I think if he can unlock just a little bit of a better movement profile, it's going to go a very, very long way, and he's going to be able to hit his ceiling, which I think is relatively high. I think he'd be a quality three starter going forward.
Yeah, definitely. Moving past some of these college players up top, we get to Alphonsín Rosario and Yahiel Meléndez. I think I said they took a pair of Puerto Rican players later on. That was a mistake by me. Rosario is from the Dominican Republic, even though he transferred to a South Carolina school for the 2023 season. But both he and Yahiel Meléndez are interesting projection players. I think there are going to be questions with both of their offensive approaches. Alphonsín has been a little bit pull happy, a little bit aggressive with his swing decisions, a little bit of just contact questions in general. Meléndez is not quite as physical now as maybe he needs to be in the future, so he's going to need to add some power, add a little bit of impact if he can in the future. But he should be able to fill out his frame. Rosario is more of this like tool shed who has interesting speed, massive arm strength, lots of raw power. So if he can improve and refine that offensive approach, you might have something with him. Melendez is more of a like savvy defensive shortstop who probably is going to stick at the position, needs to just get a little bit stronger, a little bit faster in the future to maybe add some impact to his profile overall. But I like these two picks here, especially considering they're just college heavy early on. I like adding a little bit more risk and potential upside to the package here. But who else do you like moving on past the top guys of the class, I guess?
Yeah, so it's weird to kind of say, like, to talk about a draft class like this, but I'm a huge, huge fan of what the Cubs did in rounds, like, I'd say 8 to 18, even until the end of the draft. I think that they have a chance to hit on a ton of the guys that they selected. I think starting with Brett Bateman, center fielder out of Minnesota, he really improved his stock. With a brief stint on the Cape, he hit 500, and it was a legit 500. It wasn't an 8-for-16 500. He was 25 for 50. Bat to ball skills and approach with Bateman are their calling card. He's a really tough guy to beat. I'd say he turned in 70 grade run times when I saw him on the Cape. He's an outstanding defender in center field. It's an average or a tick below arm, but the routes that he takes to the baseball, and just the ability to defend in general, it's going to allow him to stick at the position long term and make up maybe for the lack of arm strength. And again, you kind of look for player comps maybe early on in the draft as to who he's similar to. I guess you could maybe call him like a budget Enrique Bradfield, in a sense. And I know that's a bit lofty, but I think that Bradfield's
I think it's an interesting comp because we also had Victor Scott a year ago who you could say the same thing about in terms of his prospect type and has actually been quite good. So I think this is a profile that teams have shown an ability to get at like value ranges that actually can be a pretty solid picks for them. So I really like that comp.
Yeah, and getting him for 180 in the eighth I think is a huge win. And on top of just the raw speed, he's a guy, again, similar to Shaw, where the baseball sense is really off the charts. He knows how to run. He's a real student of the game. It's, again, very, very hit over power. He's going to have to, again, hit his way to the big leagues. But so far, hit over 300 if you include the playoffs for Myrtle Beach. Walked more than he struck out. Defensively, he looked really, really good. Covers a ton of ground into either gap. I think that this is someone that they're going to have a chance to look smart on and hit on because I think that he is an eventual big leaguer. And then looking further down the board, Carter Trice in the 12th for 150 was super famous after his true freshman year at Old Dominion, and then fell off a little bit sophomore year, played inconsistently this year at NC State in his junior year, but he switched from the outfield, switched from the infield to the outfield, where I think it's a 55 arm from right on the infield that was a little bit stiff. The actions weren't great. And then you kind of almost have him breathe a little bit and exhale a bunch in the outfield where he can just kind of run around, let it rip with a throwing arm. It's legit plus raw power, which I know might be deceiving with his frame. He's turning above average run times. I think that, I mean, there's wood bat track record there. I think that he's a very interesting one in the 12th. And then again, looking further down, Daniel Brown from Campbell, became a famous, somewhat famous name, I think this year, just like a super viral guy as a left-hander up to 100. I mean, I don't want to mince words here, but the command and control right now are probably a 10.
Yes, but very definitely is safe to say Daniel Brown is maybe one of the widest variance players, I would say, in the entire draft, just given where the pitchability is now. The fact that he barely pitched at all for Campbell in his career, barely pitched at all this spring. He threw just a single inning. He walked of the – I mentioned this previously, but he faced – let me make sure I have the numbers right in front of me. He faced 12 batters. He walked 9 of them. He struck out 3. So that, like, if you, I think that you might be able to see like MLB draft combine video of him, but I was at the combine and behind the little screen they put up behind the plate, just getting video of all the pitchers. And throughout this bullpen period, there would be people with cameras, like, kind of getting on the edge of that fence, trying to get clear video so you didn't have to shoot through the net for a number of pitches, and it was fine. And Daniel Brown took them out. I was like, all right, we gotta be careful here and get fully behind the net. Someone with MLB started, like, inching out and getting outside of it. And I was like, hey, like, this is not the pitcher that you want to do that with. You might want to, like, watch out, like, get behind this thing. As he's starting to move, Daniel just lets one rip, comes by, like, behind the left-handed batter's box, right beside the net, and just nails this guy right in the side. And I was like, man, he took like 92 to the gut. I was like, that cannot possibly feel good right about now. But Daniel Brown has massive arm talent and basically next to no feel for pitching. And he's extremely fascinating because of that. So I hope they're able to work with him a little bit and just find the zone.
Yeah, I mean, in the 16th round, like, how many lefties are available yearly that are 98 to 100, 6'4", good-looking body with a quick arm? I'd say it's really hardly ever happened. So, I mean, at that point, I think it's worth it to take a flyer on someone like that.
I agree.
But
think a lot of this Cubs draft class feels like just acquiring a lot of talent, a lot of stuff, a lot of tools, and hoping that your player development can refine some of the warts. I think outside of Matt Shaw, you probably could point out a wart or two with a number of the players they took in this draft, but there is a lot of athleticism, there's a lot of tools, there's a lot of power, there's a lot of just stuff to work with. So I feel like this draft class has a lot of risk baked into it, and if you feel confident in player development, just improving these players, you could end up with a lot of really good players. And if they're not able to do that, there are a lot of, like, obvious paths to failure I could see as well. So it's a fun class to watch unfold for those reasons.
Yeah. And with guys like Daniel Brown, like, no one's going to knock anyone for missing on a 16th rounder. It's like, okay, the worst thing that happens is, you know, the strike throwing doesn't come along and you can't really improve the command, and you know, I think that's a risk that's well worth taking. And then going down even a few more picks, a guy that has so far been a huge hit is 18th round pick Brian Calmer from Gonzaga. Again, pretty old finished product, more or less physically, but lit the world on fire in Myrtle Beach, hit 358 with 5 doubles, a pair of triples, 10 home runs and 40 RBIs in 32 games, I believe it was. Barrel really explodes through the strike zone, hits against the closed front side. There's really no stride or load. If you look up video on Twitter for those listening, you'll see what I mean. He's kind of already loaded. It's like the head of the bat is more or less pointed towards the mound. And he's got kind of that lifted up heel, closed front side. And it's big time bat speed, and it explodes through the hitting zone. I think it's plus power, and it's serious impact. He's looking like a right first baseman, and for guys with that type of profile, they're going to have to really hit. And so far, Brian Calmer is really hitting. So again, that's a guy that you don't spend a lot of money on. You sign him for $50,000, and you're looking really smart so far. So. Mm-hmm. A really interesting class in general for the Cubs. I think that I'm a pretty big fan of it. And there are going to be a lot of fun guys to follow going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And even after Calmer, I think guys like Nick Dean in the 19th round, like, he makes sense as a day three sort of senior sign, given his pitchability, four pitch mix. Like, there's not a lot of overwhelming pure stuff there, but he's been a solid arm. Drew Bowser could be an interesting project. Again, if player development can get the most out of him, there's a lot of physicality there. There's a lot of raw power. If they can help the strikeouts a little bit, help improve the contact a little bit, I think you might have an interesting player there. So really, from round one to round 20, there's a lot to like. Seeing how these players develop, I think, will be the key. I mean, this is the key for every class, but I just think there's a lot of volatility and a lot of upside in this class as well. So it should be a fun one. Let's move on to our next group. That is the Cincinnati Reds. They've had a phenomenal year relative to expectations entering the season. They were picking top 10. They had the 7th overall pick, and they selected right-handed pitcher Rhett Lauder out of Wake Forest, one of the better performing arms in the entire country. They had a supplemental pick in at 38 overall. They took right-handed pitcher Ty Floyd out of LSU. In the second round, they took high school shortstop Sammy Stafura. In the third round, they took Arkansas left-handed pitcher Hunter Holland. In the fourth round, they took another high school player, this time a right-handed pitcher, Cole Schoenwetter. And then in the fifth round, they took Long Beach State catcher Connor Burns, who is perhaps the best defensive catcher in the country last year. So nice mix of demographics here for the Reds. Obviously, they had access to some pretty good talent with a top 10 pick and a second pick before the second round started. What are your thoughts on them going with kind of high-performing college pitchers early on, Peter? I mean, Rhett Lauder, obviously, people all know him, but Ty Floyd is maybe one of the best examples of like a late surging prospect given his performance in the College World Series.
Yeah, I like going out and getting two really high-end college performing pitchers with your first two picks. Rhett Lauder, I think, is where they got him, I think, is a very, very safe bet and a guy that you can feel pretty comfortable with being at least a somewhat of an impact big league arm, legit plus command of all of his offerings. He doesn't have the premium velocity as some of the other arms in this draft, but he's 92 to 95, will rear back for a six with the fastball, spots it well to either side of the plate. The changeup with Lauder has long been his calling card as a legit plus, maybe borderline double plus pitch. And then the slider this year took a nice step forward. I think that it established itself as a plus offering for Lauder. And again, he commanded it well, and he was able to spot up with it. So I think that's a guy that, again, he didn't throw it all this year. I know that they assigned him to, I think, to high A, but he never threw. I think
that's smart too.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. After what he did at Wake, I think he threw 120 innings. It was very smart to shut him down. So I think that's a guy that can progress reasonably quick, and you'll probably see him in the big leagues by 2025 or so. And then with Floyd, you know, we talk about all the time guys making their stock in the postseason and in Omaha, and I think that Floyd is another great example of that. I think that regardless, he would have probably gone in the top maybe three to five rounds. But that start, the 17 strikeout start against Florida was one of the most impressive, maybe like there's an argument to be made there that it was the most impressive pitching performance in College World Series history. Obviously the calling card with Floyd is his fastball. It's 4-7. It absolutely explodes out of his hand. Tons of run and ride through the zone. I mean, he could signal it to hitters and they'd still swing under it.
That's what he did, I'd say, the entirety of his sophomore year or last year. I don't know if this was his draft eligible sophomore year, but I feel like a year ago it was 90% rate and it was still a really effective pitch. It wasn't quite that extreme this year, but yeah, to your point, one of the better fastballs in terms of just velocity and life you could find in the class.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the shape, and at least in that Omaha start, he could have absolutely signaled it to a really good Florida lineup, and he would have got the same swing and miss more or less. So, slider and the breaking ball is a little inconsistent. I think if he can get it to be a solid average offering, that'll be key. And then the changeup flash plus. So, again, I think that there's a lot to be said for these college guys that perform on the biggest stages under the brightest lights. Lauder again went toe to toe with Skeens. I think that is a very, I think it's viewed higher now by those that are drafting, but I think it's a very underrated quality to look at in kind of how they perform on the highest level. So I'm a big fan of the top two picks.
Yeah, I agree. And what I like maybe most about the top two picks for the Reds specifically is it really seemed like they paired talent that made sense at the pick with organizational needs. They have a lot of hitters in the organization. They have a lot of infielders. I think regardless of how the draft is going to unfold in front of seven, they would have found a good way to address an organizational need with just a bunch of outfielders in front. But they did get Lauder. I think at that stage, you basically are choosing from Lauder, and then you've got also Dolander and Noble Meyer who you could pick from. The Reds opted to go for, I would say, maybe the safest pitcher of that group, just given his performance, given the fact that you really don't need to project much at all on him to be a successful big league pitcher. I think he's he's pretty good at maximizing what he has now. The pitchability is phenomenal. He posted all year. That has to make you feel confident. And then after those two, I was really a fan of this class because they took another guy that I really am a fan of, Sammy Stafura at 43 overall. He was a really great performer for me last summer on the circuit, showed nice hitting ability, showed impressive defensive skill. This spring, he added some power. He added a little bit of speed. We had him as a plus runner at the end of the day. It's probably not the pro debut that you wanted to see from Stifura, but I'm still pretty high on him, and I'm hopeful that he can bounce back next year. Just pulling up his numbers really quickly. In 53 plate appearances, he hit just 0.71, 212, 190. Really struggled with the strikeouts, struck out 23 times, walked just 8 times. I'm hopeful that was just a little bit of welcome to pro ball, trying to get your bearings with him, because I am and was very high on the talent and the tools and just what he showed this year. I know a decent riser this spring, just given the strength and speed that he showed, the swing decisions, just the overall instincts and well-rounded tool set. I thought he had a chance to go late in the first round, and if not, I thought he was definitely going to go in the supplemental round. So I like the fact that the Reds were able to get him with their second round pick. They signed him to an overslot deal, but just the fact that they were able to kind of bank two solid college pitchers in a class that's not really great for that demographic and then get an upside play like Stifura, I thought was solid.
Yeah, and he was a guy that I really liked as the cycle progressed. And I know going through the spring that there were some scouts that we talked to that had him even in the top 25, top 20 or so picks in the entire draft. So a little bit of an underwhelming debut, but it's such a minuscule sample size when looking at the bigger picture. So, hopefully he can figure it out. And then again, Hunter Holland in the third, they really went, they went college heavy arm, college arm heavy at the top. Mm-hmm. Holland again, it's not premium velo. It's more, 89, 92 with the fastball, but it's two distinct breaking balls. Was really good for Arkansas this year. I think that it's a nice potentially back end of the rotation piece, fifth starter type long-term. I think if he can get a little bit more swing and miss with the fastball, that'd be key. And again, don't get me wrong. They're not drafting Hunter Holland off one start, but you talk about guys performing on big stages. He went toe-to-toe with Paul Skeens back in March at the box in a really big series. He threw 5 1/3 shutout innings and punched out 7. So again, they're not drafting him off that one start by any means, but, again, a guy that pitches with no fear. I know going into that, he pitched with a chip on his shoulder too. So, hides the ball really well. It gets on hitters quick. I think again, it's the floor with him is relatively high. And then Connor Burns in the fifth, I was excited about this pick. I know with Burns, obviously the calling card is the defense. It's a double plus throwing arm. He's an outstanding receiver. I think that as far as defense is concerned, he's perhaps the best defensive catcher in the entire draft class. It's just the key for him was always hitting, and he had his best year offensively at Long Beach this year. He hit 307 with 30 extra base hits, cut down on the swing and miss a little bit. But so far again, in his pro debut in Daytona, struck out 39 times in 78 plate appearances. So obviously pretty high. But again, I think, if they can get that in check and if he can literally not be an auto punch out at the plate, which unfortunately right now he kind of is, but if he can not be an auto punch out at the plate, I think that the defense is going to be enough to have him be an everyday member of the lineup.
Yeah, I'm very high on Burns defensively. I agree with you. I think he's the best defensive catcher in this draft class. I think it's double plus defensive potential, chance to be a gold glover if he's able to get enough of the plate appearances that behind the plate. Like, he just does everything well behind the dish. He moves well. He frames well. He has great hands. He blocks the ball well. He can make plays out in front of the plate in foul territory. His arm is tremendous. I remember just watching him at the combine, and in combine scenarios for a lot of catchers, especially high school players, there's a lot of violence and they're trying to throw as hard as they can for the pop times. With Burns, it was so smooth that it almost looked like it was in slow motion. Then you look down at the stopwatch and he's giving you like 1.8, 1.78 pop times and every throw is right on the bag. It's just so easy and effortless, and the actions are just so pure and fluid. He is really fun to watch behind the plate, so I'm hopeful that he can just clear the offensive bar for the position to get to the big leagues, because if he does, I think it'll be like a little Patrick Bailey-esque, almost like what Patrick Bailey has done this year as like a defense first catcher. I think Bailey was regarded as a better hitter at the time. That's partially why he was a first rounder. But Burns does have a little bit of power. It's just, can he get to it? Can he make enough contact? Can he stay in the zone? There are a few other interesting up the middle players in this late day two range for the Reds as well. Dominic Patelli at Miami. He had one of the better reputations as a defensive shortstop at the college level, was really not much of a bat at all through his first few years at Miami, and then really popped off in 2023 offensively, showing more power than I think I ever would have expected from him. I'm trying to see. I don't think I have here. Yeah, 13 home runs. I think he led all ACC shortstops in home runs with those 13, which I never would have guessed for him. There is some swing and miss. I don't think he's going to be a standout offensive player by any means in pro ball, but he is a reliable defender. He's got a good arm, quick transfer. So a couple of fun defense-oriented up-the-middle types later on day two.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting strategy going with these defense-first guys in Burns and Patelli and kind of the middle part of day two and betting on the offense to develop and even just be serviceable. I think that it's tough, but I think with Patelli, there's more of a track record there, at least offensively, where you can get him to be even like a 230 to 240 or so hitter with a little bit of impact. Again, similar to Burns, the strikeouts are high so far in affiliated ball. He's got 22 Ks and 74 bats, which isn't outrageous. But again, with Patelli, you mentioned the calling card is obviously the defense. It's a borderline double plus arm at shortstop. Really good fluid actions, range in either direction, comfortable throwing in from multiple arm slots. It's a big league shortstop defensively. So, I mean, if he can hit even a little bit, I think that that's a guy to be really excited about. And if him and Burns can both figure it out, they're gonna look very smart getting those guys in the fifth and seventh. But sandwiched between them is a guy that has already started to hit, and a guy that I became a fan of throughout this spring is former Virginia outfielder Ethan O'Donnell. 6'1", 190, super, super athletic looking kid. Great body with some physicality, hit really well at UVA. I think it's more of a hit over power type profile long term. But again, can really run, super, super athletic. I think the athleticism and actions are going to allow him to stick in center probably long term. I know that's where he's played most, if not all, of his games in Daytona when he's been used positionally. In 23 games, he hit 350 with 10 extra base hits, including four doubles and four home runs. Approach was there, swiped a few bags. I think that, again, it's early, but I think that's someone that you can be really, really excited about as a long-term impact guy in your system.
Yeah, he's probably been the best hitter of this class so far for the Reds. Another guy who got off to a solid start as a hitter is a day three name that's interesting. That was their first pick on day three, Texas A&M first baseman Jack Moss. There were a number of first basemen in this draft class who felt like they were more contact over power types, which is a bit odd for the position. Maybe Nolan Shanuel is like the kind of poster boy for that demographic, but Moss, it was the same thing. He always showed a solid understanding of the zone, hit for average, got on base, but never really had the sort of raw power you would expect from the position, maybe hit the ball on the ground a little bit too often as well. And that's been kind of the case for him in pro ball too. He didn't homer in his first 21 games in pro ball, split between rookie ball and low A, but he did hit for average. He hit 303. He got on base at a 40% clip. He walked 14 times to 20 strikeouts. So it's an odd profile. And even though he has been playing some corner outfield, you're going to want him to hit for more power. He has the physicality and the size that you would expect that he can get to some. But until he starts actually showing it, I think there's going to be some skepticism that he can profile as even a part-time or an everyday guy. I mean, it's an 11th rounder for a reason. But I do think he has some solid, like, foundational hitting skills and OBP skills that if you can add some more bat speed, add some more power, maybe it's just a question of him getting the ball in the air more frequently. I think he could be an interesting kind of sleeper type on day three. And he got off to a solid pro debut, so it's a fun one to start with.
Yeah, I think when we were talking about our day three sleepers, I had him circled. As you mentioned, it's a really unique profile. It's like a little bit Chanuel-esque, I guess you could say. Obviously, the walk rate isn't nearly as high, and the bat to ball skills, I don't think are nearly as good as Chanuel, but it's a very much hit over power first baseman whose approach really took massive strides throughout his time at A&M. He started as a freshman at Arizona State, hit really well. I think he earned a Team USA invite, at least a camp invite. And then he really exploded in his time at A&M and blossomed. But as you mentioned, he didn't have an extra base hit in 9 games in Daytona, but consistently put the ball in play, good feel for the barrel. You kind of wish that a guy that's 6'5", 215, left-handed hitter, first baseman, I'd say more power than this. I think that's going to come with, again, as you said, getting the ball up in the air. But so far, you know, showing that he can see the ball well, can handle professional pitching and have a solid approach, I think that's positive. And then my other day three sleeper, is Simon Miller from Texas San Antonio. He was one of the better relievers in all of college baseball, I'd say. This past year for the Roadrunners, 2.3 ERA with 81 Ks and 70 innings. He throws his slider more than he throws his fastball. Fastball is up to 97. It kind of jumps out of the hand, and the slider was also an effective offering. I think that he's more at this point. I mean, he's definitely a reliever long term, so it's hard to a degree get super, super excited about relievers, but I think that, you know, in the 12th round, someone you just throw 150,000 at, I think that he's got a chance to, you know, be somewhat of an impact arm in a big league bullpen in the future. So another fun guy to follow.
Yeah, I'll just add one more on day three. I think this is their biggest money signing on the third day. That's Kyle Henley, 14th rounder, Georgia High School outfielder. It's really raw offensively. Probably not a ton of impact right now, but he is a true burner. It's top of the scale running ability, 80 grade speed. I think he turned in the fastest run time at East Coast Pro last summer. It was a 6.2 second 60 yard time, which is pretty insane. So if he can get on base, he's going to be a nightmare for pitchers and catchers in this stolen base environment that we're entering at the big league level. He has the tools to be a really good defender as well, given that speed. I think even if you don't develop elite routes and reads, you can kind of outrun those less than ideal routes as a center fielder. So, like, he has solid tools to be an impactful player. It's just going to come down to how quickly can he advance offensively. Can he improve his approach, his ability to hit the ball to all fields? Can he add – how much strength can he add? So I think there are real questions offensively, but there are some, like, carrying tools here with the speed. So the Reds are always a team, it seems like, that really loves athleticism, and there are a number of players who kind of fit that mold in this draft class. And there are also a lot of, like, really exciting up-the-middle types who have hit questions. But if they hit on one – of those players, you could have a pretty impactful player, whether that's a Henley, whether that's a Patelli, or whether that's like a Connor Burns, or even Sammy Stafford in the second round. There are some guys who maybe you have some offensive questions now, just given their background or given their pro debuts, because, again, Henley hasn't had a fantastic pro debut in a very limited sample, but that's another fun one on day three.
Yeah, I think overall, similar to the Cubs, I'm a fan of this class. I think that they have you hit on them. They have a handful of guys that have a chance to really pan out and have a big time impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a fun young big league team now, and it seems like they've got more waves coming in the future. So we'll see if they can get some pitching to complement this young position player core they've got going. But let's move on to the Pirates. Obviously, with the number one overall pick, we're probably going to like whoever they took there. It was a bit of a question mark as to who they were taking leading up to the draft, but they eventually settled on LSU right-hander Paul Skeens as the 1-1, signed him to a record $9.2 million bonus. In the second round, they took Mitch Jebb, shortstop out of Michigan State. In the supplemental second round, they took high school right-handed pitcher Xander Muth. In the third round, they took Oregon State third baseman Garrett Forrester. In the fourth round, they took West Virginia right-handed pitcher Carlson Reed. And then in the fifth round, they took Vanderbilt right-handed pitcher Patrick Riley. So, Peter, were you surprised at all with the pick with Skeens? Is that the player you would have taken? And then what are your thoughts overall on Paul Skeens?
Yeah, so I know that the idea of taking a pitcher number one overall, there's a lot of risk involved with it. I know that going into the draft, it was an idea and a scenario that was, I think, somewhat frowned upon to an extent. But after, seeing what Skeens did and seeing him dominate again through the postseason and in Omaha, I think it became somewhat of a no-brainer for the Pirates. Like, again, there's risk involved with a pitcher 1-1, but the nine innings on the mound are going to have to come from someone. He's as sure of a bet as, there's arguably ever been that, he's going to hold down a front of the rotation spot. It's all-star and Cy Young type upside. The intangibles, again, with Skeens, I think that make him incredibly unique. Even ability aside is the fact that he came from a service academy. He started his career at Air Force. The mental toughness and fortitude is off the charts and I think unteachable. And Skeens has all that, plus the ability on the mound, and it's 99 to 102 with the fastball. I mean, in Omaha, it looked like he was playing catch with it. I know that there are some questions about the shape of the fastball. It's a little bit of a dead zone profile. I think that he found out early on in professional baseball. Again, keep in mind, this is after throwing almost 123 innings at LSU, so he's going to be a little bit, burnt out. He dominated the complex in Bradenton in his three appearances and then got hit around a little bit in Double A. And I mean, at that stage, guys can put wood on a bullet. So again, I think with Skeens, there's really no cause for concern at all. I think that if you're freaking out about 2 2/3 innings, it's a little bit reactionary. Like, yeah, the fastball shape itself isn't unbelievable, but I think again, it's supplemented by, for my money's worth, two double plus offerings in a slider and a changeup. The slider is a borderline 80 grade offering, which I think that's a hefty grade to stick on it. But I think it's absolutely a 7, and so is the changeup. So with Skeens, again, you're getting, it's lofty, but I mean, you're getting Cy Young upside. He's your future headliner. Mm-hmm. And he's got a chance to be the face of at least pitchers, in the big leagues going forward. Sans probably, Shohei Ohtani and a couple other guys.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why he was regarded as the best pitching prospect since Steven Strasburg. Like, everything you're saying is very lofty, but these prospects do come along every once in a while, even if they're not common at all. I think the changeup is going to be really key for him moving forward, and he really didn't have to use it a ton this spring, but when he broke it out, I thought it was definitely a plus pitch. And his feel for landing that pitch, I think, is going to really help alleviate any concerns you might have with fastball shape. And I think the fastball shape is maybe the one thing you can critique with Paul Skeens, but I think sometimes we go a little bit overboard with it because that is the one obvious area to critique. You can't really find too many other areas where Paul Skeens has too many obvious flaws. I think at the same time, if you're averaging 98 miles per hour, the shape ultimately doesn't really matter too much. I think velocity probably the most important thing, then command, and then after that, if you got shape, great. He's got two of the three checked off in pretty bold Sharpie there, in my mind. I think he'll move exceptionally quickly. I thought he was probably the quickest to the big leagues sort of prospect before the draft. Obviously, that didn't happen because of Mr. Shanuel, but I think he'll move pretty quickly regardless. I'm curious to see what the pitch mix will look like in pro ball, because I do think the changeup should be more of a factor against better hitters and particularly against lefties, where maybe I think the slider is going to be effective against batters of both sides, but maybe even can especially help him versus opposite side matchups. So I'm really excited for him. I think at one, it makes a ton of sense. I would have been fine with really any of the top three college players at one. And I'm kind of glad the Pirates didn't try and get super cute when they were working with a pretty elite top of the class here with Skeens. But go ahead.
No, I was just going to add a couple more quick points. I think one, he's going to pitch in the big leagues next year, whether he's assigned to Altoona or Indianapolis out of spring training to make a few starts or a handful of starts and then get called up, or he's just put on the big league roster right away. He'll pitch in the big leagues in 24. And I think that one thing that I didn't mention and you did was, on top of the premium stuff he has, it's also plus command and control and feel for all three offerings, which again, just adds to the allure of Skeens. And then we talk about the fastball shape a little bit, and people sitting and listening might be like, you know, what the heck? You know, it's Skeens. It is just like trying to find a hole, you know, in his, it is like a little bit just like poking holes, similar to Dylan Cruz's ground ball rate. Exactly. Which was similarly cited, but we can move on. I think that, you know, Pittsburgh can be very excited. They have their future one starter.
Yeah, they do. Beyond Skeens, it was a pretty pitcher heavy draft class for a farm system that's really pretty pitcher heavy as well. They took Tomar Johnson last year up top, but I think a bulk of their talent in the minor leagues is on the mound. Xander Muth was their kind of big signing after saving a little bit of money. This is kind of how the Pirates seem to operate. It's not a rare strategy. I think it's the most common strategy in the draft at this point, is to save money with your early picks and spread around later. That's what the Pirates did a few years ago when they had a ton of picks with Henry Davis. One, they still, even though they signed Skeens to one of the biggest contracts we've seen in the draft, they still saved $500,000 on his slot. They saved $400,000 on Mitch Jebb's slot, and signed Xander Muth for almost $700,000 over. I think maybe the one critique that I would have for the Pirates in this draft class is they were the only org in this division that did not go up to their full bonus pool. They were the second lowest in terms of total bonus pool spent. Only the Mariners spent less of their bonus pool at just 98%. Again, maybe you could make a case that Pittsburgh was the least aggressive in this regard because they did have the biggest bonus pool to work with. So their 5% overage is just more money to work with than any other team. So I think you could be a little bit disappointed if you're a Pirates fan that maybe they could have been a little bit more aggressive. And it's not the case with the Mariners either, where you're taking a bunch of high school players early on and maybe you need to be a little bit more conservative to make sure you get the money to get all those guys signed. It was very college heavy, as it has been a few times for the Pirates now. So I think they probably left a little bit of money on the table here, even though just given the overall pick volume and where they're selecting the draft, they're coming away with a ton of talent here.
Yeah, I agree. And going right to their second overall pick in the draft in Mitch Jebb, I think that he's a really interesting, you know, prospect in general, and a little bit of a murky profile, at least defensively so far. But you know, with Jeb, it's excellent bat to ball skills at Bradenton this summer in 34 games. It was a 90% overall contact rate with a 93% end zone contact rate. He's kind of I'd say a slash and dash guy. I mean, he's got, you know, a knack for finding a gap or shooting a ball down the line every now and again. But I mean, I think it's, you know, 7 to 10 home run type upside max. But his plus speed and borderline double plus speed allows him to take an extra base and turn a single into a double, double into a triple. And it's a little bit of an unorthodox setup. He's pretty, you know, far open and has an elbow waggle, and he just kind of flicks the barrel and lets his hands work. And, you know, his, you know, the contact ability with Jeb really shines. And, again, we've talked about, it might be the theme of the day for at least some of these college guys taken by NL Central teams, but very heady player. Baseball IQ is above average. I think in watching him, at least on the base paths, and it's, I think, a tool and an ability that gets overshined, obviously, by the flashier ones, you know, the power ability, the hitting ability. But watching him on the base paths, at least in the summer of 2022 and this past spring, and even in affiliated baseball, he's really fun to watch. He kind of take, and the Pirates have an outstanding base running system, but he's developed, and they teach down there kind of a walking lead, where you can get in rhythm, and it's been really effective. And he was 11 of 12 on stolen bases, He does the walking lead, he does the jump lead, and then taking that combined with, you know, he picks his spots to run and his overall speed in general, it's a recipe for success. And he's putting the ball in play at an exceptional rate. And I think that, again, defensively, they've worked him and split time between second and shortstop. I think that he is more of a second baseman than he is a shortstop. And I wouldn't be shocked even if they give him some run in the outfield eventually, where they can, again, just kind of let him run around a little bit, a la Chandler Simpson. Mm. I don't think he's as speedy as Chandler.
Hard to believe.
But you could stick him in center or left, where I think that, again, the speed would be enough to cover plenty of ground, and you just kind of have him let it rip with the arm that's been a little bit inconsistent from at least shortstop. So I think that you're betting on a guy to really, really hit and swing it well, to kind of progress through the ranks, and so far he's doing just that.
Yeah, good stuff on Jeb. I'm going to move down the board a little bit and go to Jaden Woods, who's a left-handed pitcher out of Georgia in the seventh round. He was a really exciting player for me. I was excited to see what he was going to do in 2023. He was a reliever his first 2 years at Georgia, moved into the starting rotation. Just a really electric, athletic left-hander with a fast arm, interesting stuff, and it never really clicked for him in a starter role. The strike throwing improvement that he showed in the Cape Cod League last summer in 2022 didn't fully carry over. In pro ball, the Pirates have put him back in a reliever role, and I think he was maybe one of the most impressive pitchers from this Pirates class. In Bradenton, he threw 14.1 innings, struck out 21 batters, and walked just three. So pretty phenomenal strikeout and walk numbers there to go along with above average fastball. It gets into the mid-90s from the left side. I think a slurry breaking ball that seems like plays up in that bullpen role, but just to see him shake off a bit of a down year in a starter role and succeed as a reliever, which is probably his role moving forward. It just seems like for whatever reason, the strikes come better, the stuff plays better out of that role. But I think that's a fun pick later on day two that's also already bearing a little bit of fruit in pro ball. So even if he didn't really live up to the hype or some exciting thoughts about what he could be this spring with Georgia, it's good to see him performing now in a pretty limited pro debut.
Jaden Woods was a guy that I had highlighted as well, kind of, you know, for the same reason you did, citing his encouraging performances so far professionally. The command and control have really been there. 21 Ks to just three walks in 14 innings pitched, 3.1 ERA. Changeups looked really good again. Given, you know, who he is as a pitcher, he's a little bit on the smaller side, doesn't have premium velocity by any means. The command and control and, you know, the pitchability is going to have to really shine and progress for Woods. And again, it's really early. They've used him strictly out of the bullpen, interestingly enough. I think they're going to probably give him a chance to start eventually. But he's demonstrated that advanced pitchability that he's going to need to. And then kind of jumping a little bit back, or I guess forwards, I guess higher in rounds. The fourth round, Carlson Reed from West Virginia was a guy that I was really excited about when they picked. 6'4", 200, a lot of room to fill out. Just an electric arm talent. And he was used at West Virginia strictly out of the bullpen. Struck out 60 in 38 innings. He was a guy, again, and talking with area scouts this spring, he was a guy that teams really, really wanted. Mm-hmm. And there were a handful of area guys that I talked to that had him as a potential day one pick. And it is just electric stuff. Fastballs 94 to 98 with a plus slider and a plus changeup. Again, I think that maybe his long term is out of the bullpen. They've tried starting him a couple times at the complex, but I think long term he's most effective out of the bullpen. And then if you're looking for maybe a pick to click in the third day, I'd say keep an eye on Christian Curtis from Arizona State.
Yeah,
he hasn't pitched a ton due to injury. He's a low mileage arm, but it's electric stuff. I think just with more innings on the mound and getting in a player development department, I think that's a guy that you can really tap into and get a lot out of. It's pretty loud stuff. The fastball is up to 97. It's a shorter cut slide that I think is a plus pitch. It's got some late teeth to it. It's a really good body at 6'4", 190. Moves really well. It's a quick arm. It's an upside play, obviously. But again, you sign him. I think they got him for 500, so pretty overslot in the 12th round. But I think it, at that point, he's worth it because there was some middle day two smoke on him. Yeah. And I think getting him where they did is very, very exciting.
Yeah, definitely. I think I would lump in Magdiel Cotto, left-handed pitcher out of Kentucky, who they took in the 11th round. Didn't sign for quite as much money, but right around $200,000. He's another pitcher with really impressive stuff. Never really clicked fully in college. I mean, he had a solid turn in the Cape Cod League where the fastball strike rate was improved, but never fully translated to the SEC. He bounced around at South Carolina and Kentucky. And just the performance overall was never quite as loud as what was coming out of his hand, out of the left side. It's a huge frame, 6'4", 250 pounds. He showed good stuff at the draft combine. If he's able to put that fastball that's been up to 97 over the plate a little bit more, there's a hard, tight slider that he has in the mid-80s. He's got a tumbling changeup in the mid to upper 80s. Probably a reliever. There's some effort and recoil in the delivery, and just given the track record of his strikes, I don't know that you can be too confident that he can make a starting role work, but getting some arm talent like this and adding it to the real solid depth of pitching you have in the farm system in this draft class, I think is another fun one to keep an eye out for.
Yeah, absolutely. And then even going back to day two, I mean, they got Patrick Riley in the fifth, who, I mean, he's been a famous name for a while, kind of backed up a little bit, I'd say, at Vanderbilt this year and maybe the back half of 2022. But again, big physical kid at you know, 6'3", 220 or so. Fastball is, I'd say, when I saw him this summer, it was 1-4, but it was multiple fives and sixes. It was super heavy. I liked the arm action, and then the cutter was a legit plus pitch. I think he struck out 19 in 10 and 2/3 innings. TBD if he's a starter next level long term. I know that so far they've used him strictly out of the bullpen, which might be where he's most effective, but another I think exciting arm that you can be happy about just getting in your system. And then I think offensively the profile of a lot of the guys that they signed, it's interesting, especially where the game is right now, at least at the major league level. And I know that this is a deeper pull, but you know, Kalai Harrison in the 18th, he's a little bit of a similar archetype to Mitch Jebb. He's a slash and dash kid. I mean, slash and dash approach at the plate, smaller kid at just 5'11", 180. Not going to hit for much power, but it's advanced feel for the barrel. I'd say a rather above average hit tool. The approach is really, really solid. And I think that defensively, he can really pick it. I saw him at shortstop this past summer where he more than held his own, but I think he can be a legit plus defender. Over at second base, which I think is where they're going to end up using him long term. But again, 18th rounder, 21 years old, he's going to have to, you know, rake, which I'm not going to write it off just yet. I what I saw this summer was really encouraging. It's short swing, again, feel for the barrel, which is always a positive trait, but an interesting offensive archetype that I think that the Pirates went with. And even like going back to the third with Garrett Forster, it's hit over power. It's an approach oriented profile. So intriguing bats, but I think the arms obviously carry this draft class.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to think about like what the Pirates have kind of been doing lately. I think it's more popular and maybe a little bit more exciting for fans to start the rebuild around hitters like Baltimore has really found a lot of success doing in recent years. But I think it's interesting for the Pirates to build around pitching and especially to kind of cap this draft off with a guy like Paul Skeens, because if you don't think you're going to compete on the free agent market for these elite pitchers, I do think pitching is probably the most difficult and most expensive position to acquire for your team. So if you're in a small market, you know you're not going to be playing in the maybe elite tiers of free agency for arms, like you've got to develop those arms yourself. And to develop pitching, you basically just have to select a bunch of pitchers and hope a few break through, because pitching development is so kind of volatile and just the health of pitchers is so crazy. So I don't really mind the strategy. And there's certainly a lot of talent they're layering onto the pitching of this farm system. So we'll see what happens. Hopefully Paul Skeens next year can move quickly to the big leagues like we all expect. He'll be a blast to watch, but there's Pittsburgh for us. Let's move on to St. Louis. A bit of a weird year for the Cardinals. It's not common we see them have a losing season. Next year we'll be able to see them draft sooner than they really have, it feels like, in my entire life. But this year they picked 21 in the first round. They took Chase Davis, an outfielder out of Arizona, with their first round pick. They did not have a second round pick in the third round. They stuck with the college outfielder demographic and took Travis Honeyman. In the fourth round, they took left-handed pitcher Quinn Matthews out of Stanford. And then in the fifth round, they stuck to the college demographic, and they stuck to the college outfield demographic, and they took Zach Levinson. So it has been very college-heavy for the Cardinals. Actually, I don't think they signed a single high school player in this draft. They took one high school player in the 20th round. That was Cameron Johnson, who Peter broke down very effectively the other day. He's going to be going to college. He's getting to LSU. There was no chance they were signing him in the 20th. But yeah, this has got to be a draft you love, Peter. It's straight college players, and they gave you Cameron Johnson at LSU to cover next year.
Exactly.
I can't imagine you are too mad at the Cardinals for this one.
Yeah, no, 19 for 20 in signing, 20 for 20 in me and guys that I can and we can talk about. but starting at Davis at the top, like super, super famous name out of high school, had a strong 2022 campaign at Arizona that I think solidified himself as at least a top three round pick, and then exploded this year to the tune of a 362 average, 17 doubles and 21 home runs, walked more than he struck out, which was probably the most impressive part of his game was, yep, I think, the strides that his approach took. Like with Chase Davis, like with word association, you're going to think, at least with the swing, it's almost a carbon copy of Carlos Gonzalez. It is just a majestic left-handed swing. He also wears number 5 like Carlos did. It's plus raw power. He hit some of the most, I think, breathtaking, perhaps aided by the camera angle, a little bit of the Pac-12 network. But, I mean, he hit some big-time home runs in big moments too. He's a swaggy player. He's got an above-average throwing arm. He's, I think, a decent defender. They've actually used him in center in Palm Beach so far, which is – rather interesting. I think he ends up probably in right field long term, which is where the arm's going to really play. I think that he's a decent enough athlete where he'll stick there too. But again, with Davis, it's the raw power is the calling card. The approach has been fine so far in professional baseball. He's just not hitting a ton yet, which is not really much of a concern through 34 games. He's got just 6 doubles, hasn't hit a home run yet. But I think that, just long-term, that's someone to be really, really excited about. And I feel pretty confident, in the ability for him, in his ability to pick it up. I think that guys are just so gassed after college seasons.
Mm-hmm. And Chase Davis feels like a player that both people who are maybe more analytically oriented or more, old school in their kind of traditional scouting tools, whichever your preference is. I feel like both camps can really like Davis a lot because he is an impressive athlete. He has the physicality. He has the arm strength. He has the raw power. And his batted ball data and his contact ability this spring was really loud as well. I mean, he hit the ball hard. You mentioned the improvements to his strikeout rate. That was really always the concern with Chase Davis going back to high school. The swing decisions he made, the overall contact ability, and he addressed those questions this spring, and that's why he got picked in the first round at number 21 overall. I thought he probably should have gone higher than Nolan Chanuel did, just given the tools and the profile. That didn't happen, but I think both those guys going in the middle of the first round like speaks to how impressive their just performance was during the 2023 season. So we start out with Davis. Let's move on to Travis Honeyman and Quinn Matthews. Obviously, you're a Boston College guy, so does that make you a Travis Honeyman guy as well?
I'm a BC football guy for college baseball. I'm a fan of zero teams. I'm as unbiased as they come.
Peter is a true professional.
Yeah, no, with Honeyman, really, I think I like the pick, getting him 90th overall. There was obviously day one buzz with him. I think that if he was able to stay healthy both this year and just in general throughout his college career, it would have helped him. I think that, you know, there are some questions about the durability. But he's a really exciting player, super twitchy kid, good athlete and a good runner. I think he showed well in center field, for BC and obviously in the summertime for Orleans. I wonder if he might end up in left field long term, which is a little bit of a ding in the profile, but I'm sure that at least at the start he'll get some run in center, at the very least right. The exit velocities with Honeyman are super, super impressive. It's a wiry, athletic frame that you can, you know, you can be excited about with, I think, the physical potential there. And then obviously just, you know, what he is now. And he's, I think he's an above average runner, you know, typical kind of Long Island gritty kid. Again, getting him in the third, where they did, I think they can be excited about it for, you know, 700,000 where he was getting, middle of day one buzz. I think that the upside here with Honeyman, is rather exciting. There's a chance for, let's say, I think, you know, three legit plus tools down the line.
Yeah. Well, as we're talking through this Cardinals draft, I think that one of the most interesting things about their draft actually is how they kind of played it financially. More than any other team, they played things pretty straight up. Maybe that's kind of what happens when you're super college heavy and they haven't signed a high school player. I think you have to go back to Joshua Baez in 2021. That's the last high school player they've selected and signed, I believe. Last year they also went straight college players. So it's college heavy, but they had, trying to find out where I had this again, four of their first 10 picks were slot deals. Jace Davis, Zach Levinson, Jason Savakul, Charles Harrison, all signed exactly for slot. And then the furthest away from slot they got on anyone was 59,600 for Honeyman, and then over slot 58,300 for Quinn Matthews. So they didn't have any crazy financial gimmicks in games, and I appreciate that because most teams just don't. So just the variety of draft strategy is interesting to me. I also like the fact that they got Quinn Matthews here in the fourth round, just given the lack of college left-handed pitchers in this class, given the season that he had. I like that pick quite a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. With Matthews, again, it's older finished product type, but I think with the track record that he has at Stanford, you know, you can obviously be excited.
Pitcher yeah, of the year. What's going to happen with next year's Pac-12 pitcher of the year? Might not have one.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, Pac-12 pitcher of the year, I know that, again, even though he was older, there was some late day one buzz with Matthews. The fastball, again, it's really 90 to 93. The calling card with him is a plus changeup and an above average borderline plus slider. I think he's going to be a really effective fifth starter. High mileage arm, the mound presence, I think, is really unique. He really doesn't care. And I say that in the most positive and glowing way possible. Like, he could not care any less who's in the other box. It's a very level-headed, steady heartbeat type guy. No lights are too bright. No stage is too big. I think that he is someone that you can feel pretty comfortable about progressing reasonably quick and that you can push pretty quick through your system. And I think that, again, he's got a chance to be a really quality fourth, probably fifth starter at the big league level. 6'5 left-hander, some natural deception in the delivery. I mentioned the ability to turn over the changeup. It had a 50% miss rate this spring at Stanford. And then the slider, again, it's especially effective against left-handed hitters, but it's above average borderline plus. So, again, you get him in the fourth for 600K, I think. Especially on top of, you know, who Quinn is as a pitcher, the lack of college lefties and polished college lefties. I was a big fan of this pick.
Yeah, they took Zach Levinson next, and then they went on a run of college pitchers. They had Jason Savakul in the sixth out of Maryland, Charles Harrison in the seventh out of UCLA, Ixon Henderson, a left-handed pitcher out of Fresno State, and then Christian Worley, right-handed pitcher out of Virginia Tech. Which of these pitchers are you intrigued by? And then I guess we probably need to mention the fact that Caden Kendall, their 10th rounder, he was the only player selected among the top 10 rounds to not sign. That was a bit of an odd one. It seemed like they had agreed to a deal, and then Kendall wanted to return to school after that. So kind of an odd situation, and it's not typical that you don't sign top 10 round guys. I think the percentage is something like 97%+ of players selected in the top 10 rounds sign. So kind of a bummer that the Cardinals are one of the teams that didn't get their full top 10 guys signed. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this collection of arms in the Kendall situation?
Yeah, so the Kendall one is obviously unique. I mean, you like top 10 round guys that are selected at a college typically don't go back to school. Brock Rodden in 2022 was a name that comes to mind. And it actually served him well. It improved his stock mightily. But an interesting collection of college arms here. I don't think that there's like, you know, a ton of upside necessarily here. I think Ixon Henderson in the eighth round is someone that piqued my interest a little bit as one of the more diamond in the rough guys. Obviously, Savakul at Maryland is the bigger name. You know, big time, one of the better arms in the Big Ten. But with Henderson, it's a consistent track record of performance at Fresno. He started his whole career. It was 100 Ks and 89 innings pitched this year with a 3.70 ERA. Similar to Matthews, it's 90 to 93 with the fastball, but an effective slider changeup combination, and also mix in a bigger curveball. There's, I think, above average strike throwing ability. I know and again, just 3 2/3, he walked 4 in Palm Beach, but again, he's just kind of, you know, keeping his arm hot with these 4-1 less than one inning appearances in affiliated baseball. I think, again, when you're kind of looking at the archetype and profile in this year's draft that, you know, there weren't a lot of, it's college left-handed pitchers, and especially those with some polish. And Henderson also fits that mold like Matthews does. Mm-hmm. And while I don't think he's as advanced on the pitchability side, I think that there is enough stuff there for him to be effective and to be a decent starter long-term. So he's someone that I've got circled again, and similar to Matthews, you can kind of push him reasonably fast through the ranks.
Yeah, and then day three, a couple guys who I thought were interesting. I liked Trey Richardson quite a bit when I saw him with Texas Christian. They selected him as a shortstop, interesting older player. And then Braden Joubert in the 12th round, LSU outfielder. He was a very streaky hitter this season, but he also has pretty impressive raw power, especially to the pull side when he's able to connect. Not sure how much contact he's going to make in pro ball. But on day three, I think the power there from the left-handed side is fascinating. Are there any day three names that you think people should be aware of or that you like here?
I'm going to stick with you on Trey Richardson. And I know it's going to be a little bit redundant, but kind of how you saw him play in person early in the season, we kind of bookended it a little bit. I was very excited and impressed with what I saw in Omaha. And again, there's not a ton there for projection or upside, but I just really liked watching him play, and he was a fun player to watch.
It's funny when you get players like that. Like, I'm not sure if everyone thought this about Trey Richardson, but he is a guy that just for whatever reason you keep coming back to and you keep finding yourself liking. Like, he hit 311, 392, 452. I don't think it's a ton of power. It's going to be more doubles than homers. He runs well. For me, he played good defense. I know there's been some kind of split opinions on his defense, but he's a very fun one to me, and like the fact that you're getting a senior like this in this round, I think is perfectly fine and exciting.
I completely, yeah, exactly. And I think for the player that Trey is, combined with the fact, you know, that he's older, getting him in the 15th is a really good spot for him. And I was impressed again in Omaha. He's a very fun player to watch. He plays animated. He plays really hard. He's a dirt dog. Defensively at second base, I know the arm strength isn't really there, which I know isn't of, I think, paramount importance at second base. But, I mean, you still want to have some arm strength. Obviously, I think that isn't quite there for Richardson, but I saw impressive range to the glove side. He moves well up the middle. I think that he's an above-average runner. And, again, I saw some feel to hit. Like you said, it's going to be doubles over home runs. But he has a knack for putting a ball down the line every now and again or in a gap. And I think at the very least, he's going to have some infectious energy and play style that is going to rub off on guys that he shares a dugout with, which, you know, is a, I think, an overlooked and underrated quality. So a nice day three pick.
Yeah. And once again, I'll just hammer home that we need to have these teams stop selecting players as shortstops who are not shortstops. Trey Richardson played second base pretty much the whole year. He's played second base in pro ball. Why was he selected as a shortstop? We have so many of these guys. So
they selected him as a shortstop.
We have him as a short listed as a shortstop, so it's pulled straight from where they.
I was going to say, yeah.
I'll check the draft tracker just to make sure it's not some weird data bug. But I feel like there are a number of players who have kind of met that that qualification. Let me double check here with MLB's draft tracker. There's list second base, which makes way more sense to me. And now I'm wondering if we have some sort of issue with where ours is pulling from, because he definitely was not a shortstop either way.
No, not at all. But yeah. While you talk about, or while we try and discover the Trey Richardson position, there's a community college JUCO arm that was selected in the 18th. That's a pretty deep sleeper and a deeper pull. It's Hunter Kublik from Umpqua Community College. 6'4 kid, 200 pounds. He just turned 20 years old. He performed really well at his JUCO, as one would expect. Struck out 44 and 39 innings. I'm going to be honest and say I don't know too much about him. But again, you're kind of looking for these deep sleepers on day three. And at least on the arm side, I think that, you know, he'll be someone to circle. They signed him for 150.
So now we have thank you for the notice on this player. Sorry to jump back in with more Trey Richardson positional drama. The MLB draft tracker, which is what officially sends players out when they're selected, has him listed as a shortstop.
Huh.
So I really need an answer to all this. Maybe it's just like they thought maybe they would try him at shortstop and he just hasn't got the opportunity yet. So why don't you? I mean, it's not super uncommon. Like, I think Spencer Torkelson was even selected as a third baseman when everyone kind of knew he was a first baseman. So it doesn't really matter. It's more of just a personal pet peeve. But overall, Cardinals class, thoughts on that, Peter? I don't love the straight college strategy that's happened back-to-back years. I wish there was a little bit more upside here, but I find myself kind of liking a lot of the players, although I don't know if I really love any of them. So I think it's playing it safe a little bit, although the Cardinals, they do a great job with player development, so maybe they just need to get these sort of profiles and they can wind up with a lot of productive big leaguers. Who knows?
Yeah. I think I'm probably, at least when talking about maybe a divisional winner for the draft class, I think I got to give it to either the Cubs or the Reds. Maybe leaning Red. I think I lean Cubs here.
Yeah.
But then one more guy for the Cardinals that I forgot to mention, top five round pick out of Miami, is Zach Levinson. It's thunderous bat speed. He's got a super, super explosive operation. And it's the exit velos are super, super impressive. There were multiple at Miami this year that were 110 plus. He gets the ball up in the air consistently. I like him a lot, especially the potential at the plate, the power potential, and it showed early on. I think he hit 6 home runs in Palm Beach, again, in a relatively, you know, small game sample size. Mm-hmm. So the power and the impact is going to be the carrying tool here, but he's a good looking body. Some physicality present, but again, he hammers the baseball and it's legit plus power.
Well, there you go. There's my upside. You've answered that question for me with the card. I think I would agree with you though. I found myself really liking the Reds draft the day of. I mean, Sammy Stifura's pro debut doesn't really help that cause, but there's still enough players that I really find myself liking in that draft class that I'll probably lean towards that one. But as always, there are players to like in each of these draft classes, depending on your tendencies, your philosophy as an evaluator, or your preferences for player profiles. So this was fun, Peter.
Oh yeah, as always.
This was a blast. So again, hopefully I get Ronnie Acuna tonight hitting 40 in person. Outside of that, we have our draft report card series that's kind of on the horizon. Just sent out those surveys to scouting directors. So if you want even more draft reviews, you can get some insight from the actual scouting departments themselves. Once those start rolling, I think probably either late September, late this month, or throughout October, we'll be putting them out as well. So keep an eye out for that from me. Anything that you want to plug that you're working on outside of the awesome freshman spotlight series that you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, we've got this weekly podcast that next week we'll wrap up the divisional recaps with the NL West before jumping into the 2024 class. And then twice a week, just going to be putting out freshman spotlights on guys that had obviously significant draft interest and made it to campus. And then also guys that at least early on in the fall, are carving out meaningful roles for each other, for themselves, excuse me. So I'll be doing that twice a week. And then we're kind of getting heavily into the fall practice cycle where, you know, you can kind of draft up fall notes on some of these teams. So exciting times on the horizon. I'm excited to get back more of a fast paced style.
Yeah. Tired of all this downtime that you've had. Well, for Peter, I'm Carlos. Thank you for listening, everybody. We appreciate it. Thanks for supporting BA in general. Hope you guys have a great weekend, and we will see you next time. Take care.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.